Shoes to Bless the World, the Reverend Dr. Rebecca Parker. Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world. The mind's power, the strength of the hands, the reaches of the heart, the gift of speaking, listening, imagining, seeing, waiting. Any of these can serve to feed the hungry, bind up wounds, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, do the work of justice, or offer love. Any of these can draw down the prison door, hoard bread, abandon the poor, obscure what is holy, comply with injustice, or withhold love. You must answer this question: what will you do with your gifts? Choose to bless the world. The choice to bless the world can take you into solitude to search for the sources of power and grace, native wisdom, healing, and liberation. More, the choice will draw you into community, the endeavor shared, the heritage passed on, the companionship of struggle, the importance of keeping faith. The life of ritual and praise, the comfort of human friendship, the company of earth, the chorus of life, welcoming you. None of us alone can save the world. Together, that is another possibility waiting. The choice to bless the world is more than an act of will, a moving forward into the world with the intention to do good. It is an act of recognition, a confession of surprise, a grateful acknowledgement that in the midst of a broken world, unspeakable beauty, grace, and mystery abide. There is an embrace of kindness that encompasses all life, even yours. And while there is injustice, numbness, and evil, there moves a holy disturbance, a benevolent rage, a revolutionary love, protesting, urging, insisting. That which is sacred will not be defiled. Those who bless the alive live their life as a gesture of thanks for this beauty and this rage.
In the late 1800s, at the height of the Industrial Revolution, many people were working 12-hour days, 7 days a week, amidst dismal conditions with very little pay. And of course, in the economically exploitive system that we live, the most vulnerable among us, the very low income, the immigrants, and even children as young as 5 or 6, worked in the worst conditions, with insufficient access to even fresh air, sanitary conditions, and regular breaks. No doubt, some of our ancestors worked under those conditions. As manufacturing increased, supplanting agriculture, and as a wellspring of American employment, conditions worsened. It took a well-organized and powerful labor movement to turn things around. Many strikes, some of them deadly, were needed to get the attention of those in power and to create the changes that needed to be changed to help the oppressed. On September 5th, 1882, 10,000 workers took unpaid time off to march from City Hall to Union Square in New York City in what is now known as the First Labor Day Parade. And that was 1882. In 1894, the Pullman Railroad strike was a notorious strike that shut down transportation in this country, and the unrest that followed that spurred Congress to make Labor Day a national holiday. But it took until 1937, with the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, for the 40-hour work week to become standard practice. And so you've probably heard, you know, the bumper sticker weekends brought to you by the labor union. It's so true. It is so true. It has taken movements of people in a holy disturbance, a benevolent rage, to create those kind of changes in our world. And so as you are firing up the grill tomorrow or enjoying the vistas from one of our magnificent Colorado peaks, give a nod to our labor unions and to your ancestors, who may have toiled in conditions that many of us could never imagine. And say a prayer as well for those who still, despite all this progress, work in deplorable, inhumane conditions because of their marginalization, not only in other parts of the world, but in this country as well. There's still more to do on this front, for sure. Now, Labor Day's purpose as a workman's holiday has evolved to give all employees just a little bit more time off, an extra day of rest, a holiday, some spaciousness before settling back into the routines of the fall. It kind of marks that end of summer. But I'm also wondering how many of you who are employed out there will spend just a little bit tomorrow checking your work email. How many teachers will be doing some lesson plans on Labor Day? How many of you will be finishing up a spreadsheet to get a head start on the proposal that's due next week? How many of you who are still employed out there, does Labor Day not really even make a hoot of difference? And for those of you who might be self-employed contractors, do you take this holiday? Or do you use it to buy some extra supplies on sale, do a little more marketing, catch up on the billing? And I certainly hope that any of you who may be working hourly jobs are getting the overtime pay that you would deserve on a national holiday. What does the work-rest rhythm look like in this digital age? Now, in talking about work, I include both paid and unpaid labor, because if you've got a to-do list running in your head, it still can feel like work if your whole body spirit is oriented that way. One of my mentors, Cynthia Winton Henry, one of the founders of Interplay and one of the wisest women I know, once asked me about how I navigate that, and she said, "Do you work with a dimmer switch or an on-off switch?" And that always stuck with me. Is it kind of a dimmer where you might be the person who can be up there on Mount whatever tomorrow afternoon and just give a quick check to your work email to make sure everything's okay and still enjoy the rest of your day? Or are you someone who needs to turn that switch off? Now, technology once created that, or the lack of technology created that boundary for us, set those limits. You walked away from your phone in your office, and you did not have any access to it till you returned on Monday. That is no longer the case, right? Now we must each find our own pace and set our own rhythms in a new way. For all the gifts that technology has given us, and that it's a flexibility of the spaciousness of where we can be, it also has created a new challenge for us. So I am definitely an on-off person. I work with a dimmer a lot, but I like that off switch. If I have too many of those days that are dominated by checking things off on my to-do list, I become listless and I feel unmoored, more like an android than a human, detached from my own center and connected only to that to-do list, to the what's next in my human doing part of my life. And I also revel in those moments of preciousness when I can give full, undivided attention to the people I am with, especially my family. So last week I mentioned Parker Palmer's description of the soul as a shy, wild animal, which needs quiet and patience to show up. Even an incoming text can sometimes be like the creak of a twig in the woods and send that soul animal back into hiding. Do you know what I mean? And at the risk of globalizing my own experience, my own body wisdom, I'd venture to say that more of us need to experience a complete rest from our work, however we define that to be, paid and unpaid, in order to feed our own souls. How great and productive and powerful and needed is that light of productivity. So I don't want to deny how beautiful that is and how desperately needed that is in this world. But if we think about it, like if we think about the increasing light that we're getting in the world, it dims the night stars. And I worry that we've forgotten what we're missing when we don't let ourselves go into that complete darkness and look up at the mystery and awe of it all. And certainly the recent eclipse gave us a beautiful example of us. It showed us the difference between 100% dark and 93%. Right? I loved 93%, but when I heard from those of you who are up in Nebraska, oh my God, right? And so I think there might be something to an off switch. And it's kind of an off switch that we're having a harder and harder time figuring out in our culture the way it is. And I have so appreciated how much all of you have understood that in relationship to my ministry over the years, and even now especially, and you've honored my current need for more time off so that I can be with my family in that three-quarter time arrangement that we have for the coming year. And I cannot thank you enough for being gracious with that shifting of staffing that we've done. Now, you might call me a 20th century fuddy-duddy, but I'm also very protective of the souls of my BVUUF staff members, all of them. Because currently there is not one staff member here who works full time. Carol is closest, our office manager, at 35 hours a week. And while I assure you of the investment in love and time of our amazing staff members, I think I have like the best staff in the whole UUA. If nothing else, by contract, their time is limited, if nothing else. But perhaps by covenant, we also should be wary or attentive or gracious to the limits that they choose to set on their time or are setting. They need to make hard choices themselves, like all of us do, on the work, rest, rhythm of their own lives. Now, our task as staff members here is to communicate those individual needs while paying attention to the needs of the whole. And that's, I think, the tension that we're all living in. We are living in times of great need. Probably bigger than anything I've experienced in my life when we look at what's happening in our political system. And this congregation is rising to meet those needs. It is a time when we are all being asked to step up. All of us. What a challenging little dance. What a challenging paradox, a challenging polarity to live in these times. We have technology that has kind of pushed it so that we have to figure out how to create this balance in our own lives and a time of such great need that we can feel inundated by it. But I tell you, my friends, if we don't pay attention to our own souls and our own needs, we will not be able to fulfill the mission before us. We will not be able to bring the kind of love and justice we want into the world if our souls are being slowly drained. And if we don't take the time to see the stars in their fullness. So this is the challenge. We need all of our best energy to do what's before us. All of it. And this is the year for stepping up, particularly in this congregation. We're about to do a build. Next week you're going to see these big plans for the building. It will not build itself. Now, you won't go here with hammers, but you will be asked to be a part of it. We'll be raising the money for it. And in the midst of it, we will be continuing to provide services for our children, to care for one another in need, to do all these things that help us, to be out in the world providing justice, to do all these things in this time. It is the year to step up. So how do we do it in a way that is both soulful and sustainable? So I'm going to offer us a few ways to think about this tension and how we might orient ourselves and our thinking, even our minds around it, especially as lay leaders in this thriving congregation. Many of these observations come from Eric Wickstrom's book, Serving with Grace, which I meant to bring up here. It's a beautiful little book, and I invite you all to read it. That's the first thing you can do. It invites us to experience everything we do in congregational life as a potential spiritual practice, so that everything we are doing is cultivating the inner depth we need, the possibility for our own self-discovery, and for using our gifts towards the common good. And I'll tell you that being engaged in something meaningful that's bigger than you, that you cannot do alone, is incredibly good for the soul, when there's so much despair and isolation out in the world. So the second thing is to imagine what we're doing, to reimagine us from jobs, tasks to be filled, to labors of love. To remember the love that is underneath, the meaning that is underneath, the desire that is underneath everything we do here and out in the world, so that that love can be sustaining. Remember, a few months ago I talked about desperate love, which is like exhausting, and a sustaining love where you are feeling it in a connected way. So to bring ourselves in the work we do into imagining as labors of love, to imagine ourselves not only as volunteers, but as investors in something larger, as owners of our common vision of creating a center for spiritual exploration and justice making, so that the how we create that center is as important as the center we are creating for ourselves and others. I'm also going to invite us to say yes when you are asked. Say yes. And if the ask isn't exactly up your alley, think about it and figure out what you might be able to say yes to that is that match for your gifts and the needs that you see. And everything I'm saying in here and imagining also out in the asks you get that are an invitation to make the world a better place. At the same time, here's that paradox thing. You have to pay attention to your own no. Because a yes that is really a no is not good for anybody. And when you begin to feel resentment, when I start to feel resentment, my little light bulb goes off that says, when I'm feeling resentful, it means I have not figured out what the limit I need for myself is. So how do I realign myself in relationship to the world so that I'm not getting that feeling of depletion and resentment, which sometimes turns into a blaming of others? It's not about others. The resentment is about how do I set that limit for myself and trust that what needs to happen will happen. And finally, probably the most important thing to imagine ourselves in practice is about gratitude and grace. We need to be continually thanking one another, appreciating all the gifts that are lifted up here, welcoming the gifts, and being gracious when we fall short, which surely we will. Part of being a covenanted community is to assume that everybody is seeking to bring their best, knowing that everyone will fall short. Naming and being in right relationship with each other in those moments of tension, and with the gift of forgiveness continuing to move forward. What we do here in this time of great need can all be spiritual practice, can all be an opportunity to welcome gifts and discern how we operate in this world, in this time of great, great need. So I'm going to invite us to take a little time, first in silence, and then to turn to someone near you. Someone you don't know so well, perhaps, or someone you didn't come with this morning. So take a few moments in silence, and then share with that person something that you already are doing to bring your values into the world and make the world a better place. And then something you might like to do as you look around you in the world. And then I'm going to invite each of you to thank the other person for everything that you are doing, because they can go unnoticed. And when we lift up that beauty, we are also lifting up a beacon of light and love in the world. So take a few moments. I'll ring the bowl. Then find someone to share something you're doing for the common good, and something perhaps you might like to do in this time of great need. And if you prefer not to share, you can just enjoy the buzz in the room and sit in silence. I welcome that as well.